back to the Hoop Stuffle podcast. Y'all know me, Nathan Schwartz. Joining me in Sacramento, Aaron Schroeder.
Good to see you guys. Good to be back.
And joining us in New Zealand, Dylan Williamson.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Who's this guy over here? I haven't seen him in a while. What's his deal? What the fuck is a possible chair?
Occasionally. Yeah, I know. I'm sorry I had to give you guys a break from actual productive basketball discourse. We're back to shit posting and one-liners.
I don't know how you're going to stretch that into 1 hour of King's monologue, but that's what you said you had for us. Sacramento, from what I've seen on the internet, almost as much discord and chaos as the long playoff drought. What's going on? Talk to me.
Harrison Barnes has done to me what 17 years of missing the playoffs could never. I think the thing is, we have the same record as we did last season at the same time, but so far we've just lost games in such crushing ways. And I know this team is better. This team is more talented. That's kind of been the issue. I mean, had we not blown a 22-point fourth quarter lead or hit our free throws against Milwaukee, I'm not even having this conversation, but we just find wild and wacky ways to lose every game in ridiculous ways, whether it's losing to the Sixers without Embiid or losing to the Hornets or like giving up 51 points in a quarter to the Pistons. While the wins are there, we have 23 of them, like we're in the play-in, you can tell that the foundation's a little wobbly.
And that's spelled out in the stats as well, where the Kings have a negative 0.5 net rating, which should work out at about 20 wins, and they've got 23 wins. So they're outperforming their point differential, which is a sign that the number in the score column and the win column isn't reflective of their true play.
That is interesting, because I feel like a negative net rating usually means like, well, we're winning all the close ones. But this just means that we're getting blown out every other game by some Western Conference team. Because the Pelicans beat us by 40 every time we look at them. Houston tore us apart. Like we it took us 3 weeks to recover from those Houston losses to get our net rating back on the positive side. But would you guys like to hear some Kings numbers that will make you a little queasy?
Bring it on.
So as of yesterday, because I didn't update these, the Kings have the worst free throw percentage in the league at 72%. That is the fourth worst by a single team since the 2020 season. We have completely forgotten how to make our free throws. De'Aaron Fox shoots 62% on his clutch free throws. Sabonis shoots 67%. And I think it's a huge reason of why our offense, it went from league best to pretty average. You cannot have teams on the ropes when you're cashing in your free attempts at a league worst pace. You're not going to be able to bombard teams the 130 points like that when you're leaving 15 points on the table. We shot 18 of 32 against the Pacers in a 5-point loss.
Does this mean I can take one or both of them off of my my All-Star reserve or roster?
Oh, sure. I don't care. Fox has averaged like 22 points in the month of January. It is funny because no matter what the Kings do, Sabonis has a double-double or a triple-double, and it's like, Sabonis, most triple-doubles since Wilt or something. And I'm like, please, please look at the basket in the crunch time, Sabonis. At least look at it. Like, I'm begging you. We had the fourth best free throw rate last year, 27th this year. So that just crushes your offense. But honestly, the biggest thing is Harrison Barnes went from like solid starter to just a non-rotational player. And it's so that's caused us to have such panic in the starting lineup. We've started Duarte at times, we've kind of gone back and forth. And when you have one starter no showing and getting like Barnes will get pulled occasionally just after like one quarter, a quarter and a half, like he doesn't have it. It's really hard to win games when your rotation's kind of fried like that. My big Barnes stats are, so there's 91 players that have played 29 minutes per game this season. Of those 91 players, in terms of per game stats, Barnes has the ninth least rebounds, the third least assists, the fifth least points, the 15th least steals, and is in a 9-way tie for the second least blocks. He has 0.1 blocks per game. There is no statistical impact he's making despite being out there for starters minutes. I have a trivia question for you guys. Which Kings player this season has the most blocks on the team?
Len.
No.
Give me Trey Lyles.
No. I'll give you five guesses each.
Davion?
No.
Duarte?
No.
Monk?
Yeah.
Malik Monk.
Malik Monk.
That's not a good sign.
It's not a good sign.
That's not a good sign.
As of right now, Malik Monk averages 0.7 blocks per game, which is good block numbers for a guard, which is first. Sabonis 0.6, McGee 0.6 as well. There's like per 36 numbers, obviously, that favor Len, that tell you Len's actually really good rim protector, which he has been. Not a great sign, though, but I will say, last season, we allowed the 26th highest shooting percentage around the rim, and this season it's the 16th, so we actually are getting better at defending the rim. Maybe it's Malik Monk or something, but I just focus on those barn stats where we're starting someone who isn't putting up, he is pulling PJ Tuckers every night, and he's not as good on defense as PJ.
I was gonna say, we started reading those numbers, I was like, is that Killian Hayes or is that Harrison Barnes? And that's not a good sign. Now, I have seen the Kings be interested in a couple of people, one of which I remember, Kyle Kuzma. You guys had the chance to run at in the offseason. He also almost got traded to Sacramento and was like, please don't send me to Sacramento. Are you guys seriously, is he like destined to be a King, or is that something you guys want, or is that like keep him as far away from us as possible?
He's got to be at some point. I do get cold sweats when I think about going all in with Fox, Sabonis, and Kyle fucking Kuzma. Like, that makes me a little scared. his contract honestly isn't that bad. It's like, compared to what Barnes is making and the production that Kuzma is getting, I would be willing to make that trade. But I'm pretty scared to give up like unprotected
real
first
assets.
Yeah, like first round picks. I don't know, how do you guys feel about a Kuzma replacement? What would you give up to get him?
Did you know that Kyle Kuzma leads the Wizards in usage rate?
I did. Like over 30%. That was my big, like, I had a usage rate graph or something. It's like, look how many high usage players there are. He was like my big sticking point. I'm like, Kyle Kuzma has a higher usage rate than Larry Bird.
are you ready for that in Sacramento?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, hey, I think Kuzma's very happy being the guy. Like, there's no part of me that thinks Kuzma's like, yeah, maybe we should sacrifice, go get a championship. He already got one of those. He's got that ring being the third option. I feel like at this point in his career, he's happy to be the first option.
Fuck, man. Him and Poole, their legacies are cemented. Like, we got that ring. I don't need to do anything else.
We're good, bro.
We're good, man. I don't have to get better at this. But what's interesting is Kuzma, like, despite being the guy on one of the worst teams in the league, one of the four worst teams in the league, because his splits are fine. Like, he's getting, I think he could get 15 points on like close to 50%. He's doing like 22 on 45% right now.
Well, now that they got him a running mate that's like a high enough caliber, a true 20 and 10 big man, like, mm-hmm. Sky's the limit. How are we feeling about Marvin Bagley in the DC, the district?
I mean, they'll lose by 40 every night. I'm not worried about it. It's I won. I don't know. I guess I lost the war, but I continually win battles.
He's one of those players that the internet is going to think is doing really great because he's a guy that will put up box score numbers when he gets minutes. And like, the Wizards are already bad, so they're not going to factor that in. But I think like his first game, he had like 20 and 10, and everyone's like, what was I telling you? Just got to give Marvin Bagley some play. And it's like, yeah, he got play on the worst team in the league, and they fucking sucked well during all of his minutes. So he's going to be a guy that like tricks people. He's going to put up these box score numbers, and they're going to be like, those idiots gave up second round picks just to dump him.
Who was saying that? Who the hell was like, who is in Marvin Bagley's corner at this point?
there's a section of the internet which will is very heavily locked in on like draft stock. And whenever a player who's highly drafted or like highly ranked coming out of college, coming out of high school or whatever, underperforms, they're like, oh, it must be the situation. And so every single player that like falls into that category of like underperforming, highly rated prospect, there is like a big section of the internet that's just like, you just got to give this. He doesn't have the right coach. He's not getting the right opportunities. Like there are people, I'm sure, that still think that like Kevin Knox is a future superstar. That he's just being held back because he doesn't get enough tape.
No, I need to talk to that. I'm going to start a new podcast with that guy.
So I'd like to tell you why Kevin Knox is about to be a superstar, because he is just bawling out.
We already have the podcast. We found him.
I think Kevin Knox is going to be a very useful role player. I mean, maybe not very useful.
He's putting up numbers on one of the worst teams in the league at the moment.
Yeah, he can space a little bit. Bagley, I did pull up the numbers. First game, good numbers and good plus minus. Second game, I know I noticed this in box score watching today, 21 is 12 boards, negative 19 plus minus, and a 4-point loss.
What I love about Bagley is he's too slow to guard anybody that's going anywhere. He could guard people who aren't moving, but as soon as they get going, it's like, I wish I could make like the cartoon sound effect, like da da da, like as they try to like get momentum with his feet. But he's like 6'8". Remember the Kings drafted him and we measured him and he's like, Marvin Bagley's actually 6'8.5". It's like, what the fuck, dude? I thought he was 6'11". and so like, I mean, sure, he's gonna get stuck like that. I did have another Kings point to touch on really quick before I forget. There's a website called Unpredictable that has like the Jerry West Clutch Player of the Year tracker. And since 1997, last season, Fox had the third highest score ever behind just 2015 Anthony Davis and 2010 LeBron. And this season, he's not on their top 50. For some reason, he has not been close to the clutch performer he was last season. And then when you lose the close ones and you're struggling to find your team identity, it hurts.
I'll be the one to ask it. Someone needs to be the hater. All last season, there were people making the argument that the Kings were playing above their heads, winning close games out of luck. Clutch performance doesn't carry. It's not predictive. It doesn't, you know, track from season to season. They were super healthy. They made all their shots, and it was basically a lucky run. Do you think, looking back, that might have been the case? That this season that we're getting from the Kings is like more accurate to their true nature, and last season was an anomaly? As the haters said.
When you say some people, you can just say yourself. It's okay.
Some bitch ass haters. I remember. One of whom is in the room.
Two of which are in the room. I feel like it's interesting because last season, I think that was true, but the team wasn't as good. And so we land at the same record as we did last year, 23-18. But this season, I know we're better. The talent is better. The overall grouping is better. But because it's been such a disaster, yet we're in the exact same spot. So yes, but we're kind of jogging in place.
Yeah, and like there are a lot of things going against the Kings. Like you said, the clutch performance has fallen off. De'Aaron Fox is like a great shot maker. Like there's nothing to suggest that he should just forget how to make shots in the fourth quarter. And Mike Brown's a good coach. It doesn't make sense that they just can't execute. There's also crazy opponent shooting stuff where by location they are fifth in the league at giving up the hardest shots. So opponents take the fifth most difficult shots against them, and yet they make like the fifth most, particularly on three-pointers, which the data suggests isn't something that your opponent three-point percentage isn't something that you necessarily affect, or it's not something that you can control. Kings opponents are shooting 40% on threes, and so like there is an element of last year, you get all the luck, opponents miss threes, you make all your threes, you stay healthy, and then it just flips. And now opponents just make every single shot.
Herb Jones specifically, the Pelicans wings specifically, like 60% against us. I understand that. Absolutely.
I do feel that as Jonas Valanciunas is that for us. Jonas Valanciunas shoots like 20% on threes against non-Clippers teams, and then like 40% on threes against Clippers teams, and like brings his average like way up just because he bombs and makes every single three whenever he plays us for some reason.
There's also the other thing is just some other teams in the West have gotten better, have taken that leap. OKC has had a very meteoric rise with Chet coming in there, stabilizing the defense, J-Dub taking the step forward, Shea cementing himself as a top, seven, to try to put an uncontroversial number out there, player in the league. Minnesota seems to have figured out how they're going to handle their three big rotation, as well as Anthony Edwards blossoming. So, the Kings did get marginally better. But like a lot of other Western Conference teams made a pretty sizable step. Clippers getting James Harden, Pelicans just having more health than they traditionally have at this point between their star players. So like it's hard to stay on top even as you get better if you're not growing by some of these big swings.
And we even got like disaster seasons from the Warriors and the Lakers. And I won't say the Suns because, they're fine. It's not disaster yet, but they're not going to win 50 games. And still, and yet, I yearn. All I do is sit here and yearn.
Yeah, I'm yearning for some better Laker days too. So that Nets loss was hard on me.
I know, Dylan, do you have any victory laps to go on? You're the best team in the room.
No, I don't think there's anything. I don't think there's anything to say that hasn't been said already. The offense has become elite. The defense is doing fine. Everybody's healthy. Like, just destroyed the Nets. Couldn't execute in the fourth quarter at all. Like, this is a scary team.
So I was really excited coming into today's recording because the Nets had a nice big lead on the Clippers. And we've teased you in the past, Dylan, about jinxing the Clippers because you come on the spot, you say things are going great.
I do it every time.
And then they lose. And we record on Sundays. And so I was like, man, it's just kind of funny that you keep jinxing them. And I was like, what if this is part of a larger trend? And so I checked it. The Clippers had not won since they traded for James Harden on a Sunday. I was so excited to bring that to the pod today. It's like, man, Clippers can't win on Sunday with James. It's a mailman situation again. He don't deliver on Sunday. It's a late night clubbing on Saturday. And then they did it today. So that just tosses all my stuff out the window. Thanks.
How many games had they played?
Three. This was four. But it was a good
huge sample size.
Well, and they've got nine more games on Sundays down the stretch, just for whatever reason.
They didn't
have a lot of early Sunday games. Yeah, they lose all three. And it wasn't even to like good opponents. Or maybe it was four and this was game five. It was Memphis before Ja returned, the Lakers, Minnesota, and then I know today would have been four, but to the Nets, but they pulled that one out, the damn bastards.
They still can't win afternoon games. If you're one of those who are inclined to put money on a sports game, whenever the Clippers are playing in the afternoon, just bet against them no matter what, you'll win.
I could fix that. I could have you guys win in afternoon games in 1 second. I'll place that bet. You guys will be in the clear, I promise.
do you think Harrison Barnes can guard Kawhi? Could we?
No, but they'll put him on. That is absolutely going to be the starting matchup. He will be guarding Kawhi. In a world of...
You don't want to get defensive superstar Malik Monk on him?
No. it's too bad because Monk has been like really good this season. In a world of Herb Jones and like Trey Murphy, I do think Harrison Barnes is the worst wing in the league that's getting minutes, that they're getting like impactful minutes. It's just so sad watching all these other teams, like these athletic, fun, they're like smiling and shit. You're like, oh man, I wish I could go over there. This is way more fun.
I don't know if I've ever seen Harrison Barnes smile. It just fits the vibe so well.
Yeah.
Do you think he likes basketball?
He smiled back when they were winning championships in Golden State, or a championship where they kicked him to the curb.
Yeah. I know. We just need to replace Barnes with Kevin Durant. That's what the Warriors did. Yeah, he has a kind of an interesting smile. It's just like, it's not gleeful. It's just like his teeth are showing.
If you guys got to Durant in place of Harrison Barnes, I think you would be my title favorite. I'm
thank you, man. I appreciate it. I appreciate it, man.
The lack of D still worries me a little bit. Like, I wish you guys had, you know, a Herb Jones too.
Maybe so, we might.
Yeah, if you could add Durant and Herb Jones to the Kings without giving up anything from Harrison Barnes, you are my new title favorite.
That's gotta be a metric when you figure out, like, is this team Kevin Durant and Herb Jones away from the title? Like, if they aren't, we gotta figure something out.
If they aren't, then they're not a top 15 team in the NBA.
because King should be around pretty average.
Let's see. So obvious ones already: Boston, Milwaukee, Philly. Mm-hmm. You add those two players, title favorites. Cleveland. If you add Durant and her, title favorite.
Yeah.
The Knicks, Milwaukee, or sorry, Miami.
For sure.
What if you add them to the Pacers?
Yeah, as they stand, right? With Siakam and everything.
Yeah. I mean, you roll out a starting lineup of Halliburton, her, Durant, Pascal, and Turner.
That's pretty nasty. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Orlando.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Still? Okay.
I'd say so.
I don't know if they're favorites anymore. I think that's where the line is.
So gnarly defensively, and then you have like Kevin Durant.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's Brooklyn without Kyrie vibes, though. It's like a really awesome team, but then like it's just Durant. Like, I don't think Paolo's a second option on a championship team.
I mean, I think he could be, but I think the guards are a weak enough spot in that point. That's the problem. But I'm enjoying this game. Chicago plus Durant and Herb Jones.
No, that's the line. That there it is.
We found it.
All right. In the Western Conference, obvious yeses: Minnesota, Oklahoma, Denver. God, I don't even want to think about the Clippers with those two wings out there. the Pelicans, are they getting a second Herb Jones? Are they now have two Herb Joneses?
Two Herb Joneses, and that's an immediate favorite.
Okay. Dallas, dear God, that would be near perfect. Wish they had one more big. Sacramento, of course. Phoenix, are they getting two Kevin Durants? Does the second Kevin Durant make them?
That's what they're missing. They're a mediocre team at the moment, but if they could add someone like Kevin Durant, that would really elevate them to championship contention.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. Like, if they had one more KD, they'd be right there. Man.
Utah?
No.
The favorites? No. But the Lakers, LA. Probably yes, right? With KD, yeah. LeBron, and David. So that's an interesting conversation.
Houston. Houston's a weird one. They've got a lot of other veteran presence there. I kind of think
KD away though. Who's there? So who's there? There's, I mean, can, I don't know.
Van Vliet, Şengün.
I feel like it's some similar thing again to like the Nets without Kyrie. Is like, I don't think Fred Van Vliet's gonna make shots when it's
favorites.
When it matters. All right, not favorites. Could contend. I think maybe in the same Orlando sphere.
I think any team with those two are contenders, except for
Phoenix.
Get Herb Jones as well. We are in a really interesting spot. Like, God, there is some awful teams in the league. But usually when there are terrible teams, there are like really good teams. My hands, you can see my hands. I've been doing something about a frame. like in 73, like the Sixers win 9 games and the Celtics win 68 or something. They're just beating them up. Like, they win 15 games just against the Sixers. But really, like, not a ton of crazy top-end teams like picking off wins. Like in 2016 with the Warriors and the Spurs, like being historically good, you had the Sixers like losing every game, but a little side tangent.
No, I mean, it's a good point because we've got like the Pistons who are 4-38 as we're recording this, the Wizards 7-34. But there's not like a team that you look at and say that team is going to have 65 wins. I mean, maybe Boston?
I do think the top is quite strong. If you look at it statistically, for example, last year's Boston team was plus 6.9 in net rating to lead the league. Plus 6.9 this year would be good for sixth. So we've got five teams that would have been the best team in the league last year by net rating. So I think the top is pretty strong. And the best team in the league in net rating is Boston, who have the point differential of a 63 win team. So the top is pretty strong. We might get some pretty high win totals.
How many Kevin Durants away are the Pistons from being the favorite? Like six? Right? I mean, it had to be like, it has to be at least a start because the bench is a disaster. It had to be at least four or five KDs.
You got to get one KD off the bench to make up for.
Four Kevin Durants is enough. Okay.
Four Kevin Durants to make four the Pistons.
Four KDs plus Killian Hayes.
Yeah. Really? I mean, assuming health. You start having some injury luck. Maybe you need a fifth just for injuries' sake, but
I don't know if four KDs could cover for Mike Muscala playing minutes in the finals.
Mike Muscala and Danilo Gallinari are essential critical parts of the Pistons.
I know. It was a win-now trade.
Have they played
gave
yet?
Up at, yeah. Yeah. 4-for-4-for-3 for Muscala, or 3-for-4 or something.
4-for-4 for for the Moose, and then 1-for-1 for Danilo, plus 22 in his minutes. Like, it's sad. They were actually very helpful for the Pistons against the Bucks. Like, I'm weighing driving out to Detroit tomorrow to catch them, because they are doing a little series in Detroit, and everyone went to the Saturday game, so the Sunday tickets are, or the Monday tickets are really cheap.
And their tiny sample sizes, Danilo Gallinari makes the offensive rating 82 points per 100 better, and Mike Muscala makes it 42 points per 100 better.
That's going to stay consistent. I'm going to Kings Pistons, I think, on the 9th, so I'll see them live. I'm excited for that.
If the Kings lose, will you need an emergency pod?
I mean, an emergency, like a trip to the hospital.
Yeah, and then an emergency room.
Seriously.
All right, we'll contact Jack and make sure that he can.
He's going to be there too. We're not going together, but we just happen to be going to the same game.
I understand. And that dance of like, hey, you going to this thing? I'm going there. You want to? Hey, sure. I see what you're doing. Well, can I talk to you guys about Joel Embiid? Are you guys ready to accept Joel Embiid as the greatest basketball player in the world?
Sure.
I started more of a fight. I feel like Dylan was willing to put more of a fight because the dude is just scoring so efficiently and so effectively. And I watched their game against Houston, I watched their game against Denver. And like, I don't think he missed in either one of those games from the like 15 to 20 foot range. Like he just stands there and like does a little jab. And if you crowd him, he drives. And if you don't crowd him, he shoots. And if you reach, he's very good at doing the Tim Duncan under swoop. Like, let me make a little bit of contact with your hand so it counts as a foul. And then I hit this mid-range jumper and it's free throws. I check the numbers on it from 16 feet to the three-point line. He is shooting 52%. That mid-range shot, yeah, that is crazy. Like, normally if guys hit like 45% from there, that's a great shot for him. 52% in the deep mid-range, that is really good.
Go ahead, Don.
It kind of was that shot a couple of years ago that sort of elevated him from, you know, all-star to like superstar, was when he was able to get that sort of in-between game going. Particularly mm-hmm. like, you know, like that baseline mid-range sort of post-up, sort of ISO face-up game. And we've seen that in other players. Like that's when Anthony Davis, for example, went from all-star offensive player and all-world defensive player to just all-round, you know, world beater, was when that like mid-range started to fall for him. And yeah, like 50, you know, over 50% on long jump shots is just so difficult to deal with, especially when you're still making, you know, 70% of his shots at the rim. And we talked about it before as well, that the passing for him has now reached another level. 32% assist percentage for Embiid now, which is pretty, you know, getting pretty ridiculous.
He out-dimed Jokic when they played. You know, I would have expected him to win the points. I would have been okay with him winning the rebounds. But, you know, the passes were not of Jokic's caliber. He's not doing that over-the-head, no-look pass as the Jokic has. But, you know, it was good moves. It was, I'm going to post, I'm going to spin, and then I know where the open guy should be. And if he's there, I'm going to make that pass.
It is so interesting with Embiid because he is the best player right now in terms of how guys are currently playing, and we can go back and can compare stuff, but he is playing at just such an otherworldly level. Like it's like Wilt level numbers in terms of scoring, but looking like the top of the East, just the best teams, the East, it's Boston, Milwaukee, Cleveland, the Knicks and the Heat. And then the Sixers are the 3 seed. Like all of those teams have a pretty good defensive center, like someone that can face up and beat. Like he's not going to get to pick on shitty teams and pick and choose. Like the talent he's facing, I guess, and the foul drawing and the flopping and like the falling to the ground is just as evident as it's ever been. And so I still like am nervous because let's say they play Boston, like let's say it's first round versus Miami, like that game where he's like 5 of 17 from the field is coming. I promise. And maybe he's better than he was last season, but that's still gonna happen just because those ticky tack fouls like dry up come playoff time. They're non-existent.
I'm willing to live without the tic-tac fouls, which like he does get a lot of those, but also just hitting from that mid-range that consistently. I pulled up Davis's stats because I remember that, and I didn't remember what he was shooting. Davis was shooting 43%. We're talking 52% from that deep mid-range. Like that's just go throw the ball to him there and have him shoot it, and you can't put a smaller guy on him. You have to put one of your bigs out there, and he has to just to get close enough to be able to challenge, and that gives Embiid a ton of room to drive. If so, I mean, what if you take away the ticky-tack fouls, he still is going to get another 6 free throws game. Like if you cut his free throws in half, and that's probably what we're looking at, he's still going to get the other ones. And then the increase of minutes, if healthy, which has been the biggest concern and feels like the biggest caveat, I think I'm ready to say Embiid is my favorite for MVP and maybe the best player in basketball.
Yeah, that was like a big dilemma coming into the season of predicting who was going to be MVP, because you pretty much had to scratch Joel Embiid because he fell into this thing of, okay, he just got the MVP and then he underperformed in the playoffs. Like there's no way that they're ever going to give it to you again. Like that just doesn't happen. You disappoint them in the playoffs. You make the voters look like idiots for picking him over Jokic, and then Jokic winning, you know, dog walks the entire league while Embiid's going 5 for 17. But he somehow reached a whole new level where he probably is going to be MVP again, even though there's that unwritten rule that says that he's not going
to
win it.
I just don't see anyone else jumping out to really take it. I've been trying to watch a bit more of OKC of late, and I wish I could make a better case for Shea. But one of the big things that really helps Shea is that he is he's a two-way impact guy. And I'm watching them play Minnesota this morning, And he almost never is making an impact on defense. He is on Mike Conley, who did have a terrible game, but it's Lou Dort matching up against Anthony Edwards throughout the whole game. It's J-Dub taking on Karl Anthony Towns. It's Chet backing him up. And like, Shea is there. He's providing help defense, but he's not the primary guy. And I think if you put a lot of other guys in Shea's situation with three other really good defensive players around him, like, yeah, Trae Young's going to look better on defense playing next to J-Dub, Chet, and Dort than he looks in Atlanta. Like, there are other really good things for Shea. I just haven't found the thing that's like, this is the silver bullet for the Shea case for MVP.
It's just a little bit short. I think Shea does lead the league in deflections. Like, he is very active in the passing mm-hmm. lanes and whatnot. And so there's defensive value. But really, the only thing that's going to stop Embiid from winning MVP is his health. Can he play in enough games? He's missed 10 already. You get 17, well, I guess 18. That's a sprained ankle away. Like, you got to be a little bit nervous. But it's not like he's been banged up and it's like, oh man, he takes games off. He takes these games off. He plays every other game, doesn't play on back to backs occasionally. So that's really all that can stop him. But it does feel like he's back at the top, where in the offseason I said I did not think Embiid was going to be top five in MVP voting. A huge piece of that is I thought the Harden dilemma was going to drag the Sixers to the bottom of the ocean, but they just shed that off. Fuck that guy.
Yeah.
Won a bunch of games. And then Embiid's come to a different level. But I compared it to like 07 Dirk, where they give him the MVP. He loses in the first round. They're like, how fucking dare you? Like, don't you ever do that again. And he's not top five in MVP voting the rest of his career. But Embiid's gone to a different level and the team's just as good.
Do you think if Embiid goes out and continues to play as awesome as he has the entire season and then plays 63 wins and isn't eligible for MVP, do you think you're going to be happy with that rule? Or do you think you're going to be like, okay, this is kind of silly?
I'll be happy with it. I still be happy with it.
I will be okay with it on how much the other guy plays. It's like, I don't like the idea of Embiid losing it with 63 if the guy that wins it has 67. Like, at that point, like, it's not a big enough difference. I really wish that they had made it like a staggered thing where, like, all right, for MVP and first team, you need to have 65. For second team, you need to have 60. For third team, you need to have 55. Because I think that's kind of how voters have even done it in the past, where, like, all right, Durant plays and he's amazing and he's fantastic, but he only plays, or Curry played like 52 games, but it was 52 amazing games. All right, well, that's not more valuable than 75 games of someone else, but we're going to give him third team. And so I wish that was where we were at.
Yeah. And that was one of the reasons that I hated that rule when it first came in. Even though my team is clearly benefiting from it as like the third best team in the league, because our guys are playing now when they used to sit every other game, is one, I didn't like them forcing players to play if the medical staff suggested that the best for their long-term play is going to be to rest a game. I didn't like them being forced to play. And then two is, I didn't think it was necessary to include that rule in all NBA because the voters were already doing it. Just like you said, like, they weren't out there giving MVP to a guy who played 48 games, except for maybe like one Bill Walton year or something, you know?
Yeah, it's like 60, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a pretty low year.
It was the players, though. The players voted for that, didn't they? Anyways.
I don't remember what switch, but something
it's,
around that.
It's Kareem's 80 MVP, 1980. It flips over.
And so, yeah, like, this was already being done in a way. And I don't like the idea of, like, a guy playing 70 games as, like, a fringe all-star getting All-NBA over a guy who's plays 63 really elite games.
For me, the biggest thing is this is not here to punish guys for missing games or like pick on Embiid for taking off back to backs. This is just to try to reverse this like plummeting trend of the best players in the league not playing in basketball games. I graphed out how many the average amount of games all NBA players played since 2000. And really from 2000 until 2017, it hovered around 76 games. And then since then has come down where last year it was 66 and than 67 the year prior. I think the medical staff will tell you, I mean, playing basketball is bad for your joints, is bad for your knees. Like, the less games you can play in 55 games and be ready for the playoffs, that's the best thing to do. But there's a season to play. There's 82 games to play that we've always been able to do for all of NBA history. So it's not about like 60 games. I just think it's insanity that we'd even consider giving the MVP to someone that is playing close to 60 games. If Embiid gets to 62 games, I mean, I think Bill Walton played more of that, and he's playing on one foot the entire time. Like, we have to get our stars in basketball games again. So I do like the rule, because I'm trying to get guys to fucking play ball again, man.
And it really does seem to be working. Like, the superstar resting has pretty much been, I mean, I can't think of an egregious example. And my team was the worst of it. And now we're having a really awesome season and everyone's staying healthy despite being forced to play.
Yeah, there's still been a few where, like, LeBron's like, hey, I'm just not playing.
He's 39,
this one.
Though. That's fine.
Yeah.
There is some exceptions, though, isn't there? Or is that to something else?
LeBron is an exception. There's an age and a minutes total.
Yeah, it's like 10,000 minutes, or I don't know.
I think it only applies to like LeBron and Mike Conley. Are like the two guys
Steph,
that are allowed to play.
Yeah.
In 2011, the average All-NBA player played in 78.8 games.
Whew.
Holy shit. What was going on? Like, I mean, the guys played the entire season, basically. The only outlier really is 2007. I think it's like Shaq, Amari, and Yao get hurt, and so the center position is like, Yao plays like 50 games in his third team, so there's the center position bringing that down.
Which, like, I mean, you could choose between him or giving it to Jamal McGlure again, and I think giving it to Yao 50 games as opposed to recognizing Jamal McGlure is probably where you want to be. So, you know, not too concerned about
that. Sure.
Yeah, I appreciate what the rule has done. I do not like the fact that it took that rule to make this happen.
We've never seen ever the All-NBA average dip below 65. And so we're just saying, like, an unprecedented amount of games missed is the minimum. Like, that's what it takes. If it was 70, that's like, okay, that was above the average last season. Like, that maybe that's too much, but 65, it's like, that's generous.
Yeah. So one of the other things is with All-NBA, you're then eligible for a Supermax. I kind of wish they had just said, if you're below 65 games, you're not eligible for Supermax. Like, hit him in the pocket. Like, not necessarily hit him in the pocketbook. I'm pro-labor. But, like, you know, instead of getting rid of this arbitrary distinction that we use and we look back on for history purposes, like, I don't think a lot of players really care about being named third team, other than what it does for status and for paychecks, basically. So, like, just take away that incentive. Take away, like, that part of it. Still, let's be able to name Joel Embiid MVP. But that's where I'm at. And that's where I've spent my week watching. Also, really great game, Denver against Philadelphia. Philly really came through, played well in the clutch. And then Denver, who did they play in their next game? Jamal Murray was, I watched too many games in a week.
Boston, right?
Yeah, it was the Boston game. And fantastic final 5 minutes. Almost no foul calls until the final, like, 30 seconds, where I will say, I do think Porzingis, yes, it was over the back, probably not a call that you want to make in that moment. And then because you blew the whistle there, I would have wanted them to maybe blow the whistle on the next play as Tatum drives, like, either swallow the whistle on both, don't blow on one. But it was a really fun game. I enjoyed both those games. Basketball is good.
I decided there should be no timeouts in overtime. It's stupid they get two each. And maybe the playoffs you get two again or one again or something, but God, the end of the fourth quarter already takes so long, and overtime is just an extension of that, basically. Let's go. Let's play, man. No timeouts.
I was watching the Denver-Boston game live with my wife, and she doesn't watch a lot of live sports because I don't watch a lot of live sports. I do a lot of my games the next day so I can just burn through them in 45 minutes. And she's like, oh, hey, there's like a minute left in this game. I'm like, yeah, we'll be here for another half hour. And then there was like, hey, there's 17 seconds left in this game. They inbounded it, and they couldn't get the play, and they called a timeout. She's like, what, why was there like 12 seconds? And then another timeout. I was like, that's the fourth quarter of basketball. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I feel like that saved a lot of men or people watching basketball while their significant other's trying to get their attention. It's like, no, look, there's only 2 minutes left in the game. Like, all right, carry on. They come back half an hour later, and they're like, why is it still going? Like,
do you guys
remember timeouts, there's some fouls and reviews.
Do you guys remember Suns Clippers in 2022? The DeAndre Ayton put back or alley-oop? I'm sure that's imprinted on your frontal lobe, Dylan. But Jim, do you guys remember that fourth quarter? How long it took, and like the Patrick Beverly review and
I
some review?
It,
like
I had it, and it Eternal Sunrise out of my mind.
Oh yeah. So what happened in the game?
I can't talk to Yanfei Aiden anymore. The internet's banned me from talking about him. Too negative.
Beverly like slapped the ball out of Booker's hands, but he slapped his hand first. But like the review, you can't change it to a foul, which is fucking so stupid. So it ended up being like Clippers ball because it touches Booker's hand, which is being like forced out by Beverly's hand. It's like, oh my goodness. And that it was like a 15-minute ending culminating in the 8-in alley-oop. I was rooting against the Clippers, so I was having a great time with them. It's a great game.
I'm gonna say this is an unpopular opinion. I want to put more power in the hands of refs to make the right decisions when it's the wrong call, because like something like that, you could say, hey, hand is ball, so it's not a foul. And he pushed it, and he touched it less. But he only does that because the player from behind hits him. And, like, reading up on early NBA, a lot of guys said, like, this one guy was the best ref. And they talked about him, and they're like, yeah, listen. He'd be like, listen, you probably fouled him, but it wasn't enough that I want to call a foul. But the ball went off of him, but I'm just going to call it off of you because that way I don't call a foul on you. And, like, then they get the ball. And that's just the most fair thing, like, for everyone in this circumstance. I'm like, yeah, all right, you know, just on the court arbitration, like, yeah. I don't want to call fouls, but we want to give them the ball back. Like, just make the right fair call. And
particularly on like on ball steal where the ball gets dislodged and goes out of bounds. In football, they have this as like, not who did it, soccer football, they have it as not who did the ball touch last, but whose action caused it to go out. And so that's like an easy thing to do. If you're reaching in for the ball, but then it happens like touch the dude's toe as it goes out of bounds, then like you're the one that caused it to go out. So you don't get possession.
Yeah. You're like running to try to get the rebound and your force of momentum pushes the ball and the guy holding it out of bounds. Like, it's not that guy's. Well, I don't know. It feels like there's an easier way to judiciate the game than watching a million replays and trying to make the exact right call down a fraction, the micro, you know, thing. Like, what, you know, do you guys remember the LeBron, was it a three, was it not a three, let's watch this from 1,000 angles, whatever happened to playground rules, just shoot for it, LeBron. We can't decide, you get a free throw.
Oh my god, that'd be awesome.
I decided I'm that
the results are inconclusive, so you shoot a free throw.
I decided I'm very much anti-review and coach's challenge. I think they had it right in the 80s or the 90s, they would just fuck it up. Just a terrible call. I don't know. I really think that that's like part of the value in sports. Like maybe not every call was right. And that's just a part of this game, is that some of the calls are good and some of the calls are bad. As long as it's not like openly fixed, which it might have been at some point. But I don't think you have to get it right. The other thing is Mike Brown takes every coach's challenge he has and wipes his ass with it, just throws it away in the second quarter. So maybe that's why I'm so upset about it. But I don't think you have to get everything perfectly right. There's a game in the AFL, 1961, it was Patriots versus Texans, and a fan comes from the back of the end zone and breaks up the final pass, and that was it. That was the end of the game. Patriots won. I'm like, what's this guy doing here? And it's like, I don't know, the game's over. It's zeros on the clock, and everyone went home. Like,
bring that back. I want that. Bring it NBA, back. NBA Finals. Jokic is taking the game-winning shot. A fan comes out of the crowd, blocks the shot.
Oh, my God. That's no, the game. That is too far.
But there's value in that.
What about this? Coaches' challenges can only be employed in the final 5 minutes of the game. They will cost you a timeout, and they can only be employed if the game is within 5 points.
Say 10. Make it 10.
Okay.
I have a no coaches challenge and no replays. Just call the game. No timeouts. Basketball. Pure basketball. Unadulterated basketball.
Yeah, I will say that when you're like watching a game and it's a 10-point lead or it's like a 15-point lead, and you're like, can we maybe get back in? And they're like, all right, let's just do a review to see who this went out of bounds on. I'm like, I've lost all interest at this point. Like, if it is beyond X points, I don't care about getting this call right anymore. Just play the game. Just keep momentum going.
Yeah, that's an easy fix. That's like uncontroversial. Like, no reviews if the game is not within 10.
Yeah, boom, we've solved it. NBA, you're welcome.
All right, we are pushing an hour. Do we want to talk about the biggest news of the week? Pascal Siakam getting traded to the Indiana Pacers.
Yeah, so Pascal was traded to the Indiana Pacers. Bruce Brown is now a Raptor for the next 2 weeks at least. He'll be a Raptor. Raptors also got 3 first round picks, 2 of which are going to be in this draft, 1 from the Pacers. 1 is the worst of 4 teams' picks including OKC, so it's probably going to be somewhere 27 to 30. And then one is an unprotected, or no, top four protected 2026 Pacers pick. How are we feeling?
I really liked it for Indiana. I think getting a star like Siakam, who on paper pairs really well with Halliburton, is just crucial, because you're not going to get a free agent like that. Like, if you had to like court Pascal Siakam, he flies into Indianapolis and he's like, holy shit, this is a terrible city, I hate this place. And like, you're not, that's not going to work. So you trade for him, right? I don't think they gave up nearly enough for me to be worried about. Like, Bruce Brown hadn't been playing particularly well. Like, while I think I like his fit basically on Denver, he hadn't been tearing it up in Indiana. Plus, like, the picks just isn't enough for me to worry about it. I think in like the picks this year, it's not a great draft class. It's like the Pacers are pretty good. The 2026 one is fine, but that's like Halliburton. I mean, if you can extend Siakam, it's Halliburton and Siakam picks. That's probably not going to be great either. So I think it's a win for Indiana.
Yeah, I agree. Like, you get an all-star level player who also fits really well with your team as like a guy who has some size on the at the forward spot defensively, but also can help out with defensive rebounding and really fits well into a high tempo offense. Pretty much the only way that Siakam is able to score effectively is by getting downhill, and his scoring efficiency in transition like skyrockets. In the half court, he's a pretty good player. In transition, he's an awesome offensive player. And now he's got a guy who, a team that pushes the pace, pushes off of makes, pushes off of steals, pushes off of rebounds, and it has a guy who can find players in positions to succeed. He's basically Obi Toppin, but twice as good. And like Aaron said, gave up, you know, some assets, but nothing that really kills you. Like, looking forward, they're not in a compromised position. They don't have bad salary. They don't have huge contracts that are coming due. They aren't out a huge amount of first round picks. And so you're in, you got a really good player who fits really well, and you're looking forward, your books and your pick situation is fine. And so I think it's definitely a win for Indiana.
I came out initially less in favor of this, and I think I'm still less in favor of this for Indiana than the majority of people. Aaron, what did you give it trade grade wise? I saw a TikTok. Was it like an A for Indiana and a B for Toronto? I
did B- the inverse. For Toronto.
Yeah, I did the inverse of like an A for Toronto. Just given where Pascal was at, I didn't think they had any leverage. I thought they got decent return getting Bruce Brown, who they could then flip again potentially for another first. You know, if you end up with four firsts off of Pascal deal, I think that's pretty high a leverage. I'm starting to consider whether or not I would include Austin Reeves in a Bruce Brown and Dennis Schroeder return. I think that might actually solve some of the Lakers' problems.
That's juicy. It is.
It is. It solves a lot of the Lakers' issues.
And creates big new ones as the Lakers cycle.
Big new ones. Of course, it's also, but that's neither here nor there. For the Pacers, I was initially worried about giving up those picks, looking at them more like, all right, you're going to have two picks in a bad draft and a top four protected in who knows what that draft looks like. And then you have all of your future assets that you can still move to try to acquire someone else. I think where I'm still just less a fan of this is Pascal is already 29. None of his game tells me that he's going to age well. Like, he is a downhill forward that doesn't shoot particularly well, incredibly streaky shooter. I think once he loses some of that speed and athleticism, he's going to tail off very quickly. And I'm a little bit worried now about re-signing him, because you're going to re-sign him to a max. Like, I don't think you're going to get out of this without putting him on a five-year max. I know India was really excited about getting him with those bird rights. Bird rights means we get to pay him an extra year. So you're going to employ him through age 34, which would be Tyrese Halliburton's age 28 season. Like, you're now giving the rest of the early prime him to this Pascal deal. I don't know that I love that as the fit. I don't know that he is a good enough player to be the secondary running mate for Tyrese. And I don't know where they get the third guy. So I'm still just kind of in a bit of no man's land. I think it's still a B for the Pacers in my book.
Those are good points. The 29 thing's interesting. I think they'll get three good seasons out of him. Like, I don't know what the all-star team looks like anymore, but I still haven't really figured that out. There's so many good players. But I think by the end of that deal, it's like, shit, dude, we're paying Pascal Siakam this much money. But I don't think they'll be sad about it or frustrated until pretty close to the end.
Mm-hmm. The counter perspective on that is I do agree with everything that you said. Like, this is a guy who's about to get paid and is about to start declining. Like, they're going to immediately pay him for his decline. I think the counter argument to that is that the road not traveled is either like an inferior player or it's nothing. And so you sort of stay in this state of mediocrity where you're too good to get extra help through the draft, but not good enough to be a real playoff threat. And then, like I said, they're not going to get high profile free agents, so that's off the board. And so then the only other option is you go even more in on maybe a better player, and you compromise yourself further. And that's probably a guy who, again, is older, because 24-year-old stars don't get traded. And if they do, you know, there are other teams that have better assets. And so I do share the concern that, like, this is a older guy who's about to start declining most likely, and they're going to be paying. But I don't think they could have got anyone better. And then the only other option is to just stay kind of good and not be able to take a step forward.
Yeah. I mean, the other option is just internal development and base. Do you trust that you've got other guys in-house or the ability to develop someone else in-house to get this good? Pascal.
And I don't think Mathurin or, Naismith are top future All-Stars.
At the same time, though, they didn't give up any of those guys. So
And they still got their chance for internal improvement.
They're just got now a guy that's going to take up 35 minutes a night blocking.
Yeah, maybe Buddy Hield will change his age again, and he's actually younger than we all thought, and he's got perspective. He's got a chance to share.
He's
going to
redevelop. It's like a Pokemon going backwards.
Yeah, remember when I said I was actually 28? I was wrong. I actually am only 26. I'm going to give it.
Now, I gave the Raptors a good, pretty solid grade because a huge part of that was like the day before I made a Masai Ujiri video, just like ripping them apart, basically saying, because the report came out that Siakam wasn't going to sign a long-term extension with anybody. He wanted to test for agency. And that was like nail in the coffin. What is Masai Ujiri doing? Because I didn't like the return for OG. I thought the price tag at least was reported to be a million times higher than that in years prior. And while maybe I'm being too harsh on him for not seeing the future, it does feel like he got every single one of these pieces wrong on when to sell them, on when to get assets and when in exchange. I guess looking back at the 2019 team, that entire team walks for nothing. Like that entire championship team is just gone. Kawhi leaves, Danny Green, Marcus Gasol, Serge Ibaka, Fred VanVleet, Kyle Lowry's a sign and trade for Goran Dragic and Precious Achiuwa. You're not getting anything back. They traded Norm Powell for Gary Trent. And it's like, all right, now we have OG and Siakam. What can we get for that? And if it's like some mediocre first and RJ fucking Barrett, gross. What happened? Totally mismanaged this. And some of it's out of their control. Kawhi was going to leave those guys. Like Serge Ibaka was old. Marcus Gasol was old. But still, like, it does feel like this is one of the worst timelines it could have been for Toronto.
Yes, in the sense that if you trade him a year prior, you get more for both OG and Pascal. No, in the sense of like, I traded him at that moment, I thought they got surprisingly high value. Like, it's like driving your car into a ditch and then like, could have sold this for $10,000 yesterday. Now it's totaled, but hey, you still gave me a grand. Like, it's hard to feel like it's a big victory, but you know, if your car's totaled and someone gives you a grand for it, you're probably happier than $500 for scrap.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, and the valuation really does depend on what time horizon you are taking into perspective. As a long-term play, this is terrible. This is really bad. We came on multiple episodes and implored Masai to do something for a couple straight seasons now, whether it was trade for Kevin Durant to build a championship team with all these good role players that you've got that would fit really good around a superstar, or move early enough because your team is mediocre and you've got all these valuable pieces. And he did neither, didn't make a big move and also didn't sell those guys, but at the peak of their value. And so from a 3-4 year time horizon, this is really bad. But considering only the bad situation that he left himself in, the return is, it's all right, yeah.
The other thing is the timeline within this own season of trading Pascal at this point was a good move. It does give them a chance to lose more games, which right now they're in the seventh. They got the seventh worst record in the league. They've won one more game than Memphis, which is just kind of crazy to think about. Like, Memphis had Jaws suspended, has had some major Marcus Smart injuries. Steven Adams out the entire year. They signed a guy off the street in Bismack Biyombo and then just decided to cut him.
Yeah, because... he signed him, he played well, and then they cut him.
Yeah. No, he was like their starting center. I'm really surprised that someone else hasn't picked him up at this point, because like there are a few teams that could use another or big man. But I don't think they can get worse than sixth. Like, I don't think Toronto.
It's impossible. You cannot catch Washington. The Pistons are, although the Pistons are interesting because they are gonna try to get better. Like they might like give up a couple seconds for Bruce Brown or something and be like, we just need NBA players, dude, and try to, because at this point they're in real danger to not win 10 games, like to be the worst team of all time. And that's something you kind of want to avoid as a front office. I want to mention that I pissed off a lot of Raptors fans. I have a ton of angry Canadians in my comments about my Siakam videos. And I kind of feel bad because I liked quite a bit of them. Like I was like, oh, I know that guy. Now he's like really mad at me. But I had someone tell me like we have a top six offensive rating since the OG trade. I'm like, but what's the defensive rating? It's bottom two. It's bottom two. You guys are losing all these games. So these moves obviously are not a retool. They are rebuild. And I had kind of predicted they weren't going to trade Siakam, but they were going to try to retool this again, which would have been a nightmare. So I'm happy that Toronto picked a direction.
Yeah. Also, did you see Jontay Porter got paid, I believe it was $10,000 by Bruce Brown to give up number 11?
Gotta be the worst financial decision in Bruce Brown's life. It's like, damn. Couldn't wear a new jersey for a couple of days.
He's spending all that Indiana money.
He's like, yeah, they gave me $20 million. Like, I gotta figure out something.
What's 10K?
Plus, I think that's a business expense, right? It's like, is that a tax write-off? Well, gentlemen, this has been a lively, fun pod that we came into without a ton of a plan. Do you have any more takes for the week?
Honestly, some of the best basketball discourse towards the end with Siakam that we've had on this pod. Like legitimate quality stuff. I'm proud of us.
And we'll be back to break down the next part of Toronto's trading as soon as they move Bruce Brown. Be the third Raptor trade that we've talked about.
I don't know, man. He's invested. He's $10,000 in. He's in there for the long haul.
He will be a Laker, a Knick, a Heat, a 76er. I like the idea of him with
Phil. He will be a Piston. They are going to give Joe Harris 2 seconds. Joe Harris in 2 seconds. He's going back to the team that drafted him.
Hey, you liked living in Indiana? Not the biggest fan of Toronto. What if we split the difference? Detroit? Detroit, that's in between.
It's in between there and hell. It's on halfway down.
No, hell's like 20 minutes south of Detroit. Oh, okay. We actually have a town, Hell, Michigan. And it is like 20 minutes south of Detroit.
Okay.
There's a marathon that you end up running through hell. Get a little t-shirt. Maybe it's 5K.
Cool. That is cool.
Yeah. Ran through hell.
Bruce Brown's going to have one of those shirts, I promise you.
And it won't cost him 10 grand to put on that jersey.
That's for free. For free. Cost admission.
All right, Aaron, where can the people find you?
Possible Chairs on TikTok, Possible Chairs on Twitter, and this podcast all the time.
Dylan, where can the people find you?
On the Hoops Temple podcast, and you can follow my Letterboxd, Dr. J. Whoa, Williamson.
Let's go.
Oh.
Come on.
You can find him running through hell as well. Getting
are you guys are you guys are you guys amongst the film watches social media?
I haven't been. I've watched plenty. I have some app that's like, is it Letterboxd? I don't think so.
I'm not on Letterboxd, but I always think that I should be. And then I don't think you guys need to see how much I watch some movies. Like, you know, maybe we don't.
I forget what app it is, but it's like you keep track of the movies you watch. You give them a little score.
Yeah. Sounds like Letterboxd. Yeah.
Sounds like Letterboxd. And what was that Letterboxd handle again?
It's Dr. J. Williamson.
J. Williamson.
I set myself a goal of 100 movies this year, so that's my way of keeping track.
Nice. Find me on TikTok, Nate_HoopsTemple. You can also find me here, and you can email us all, hoopstemple@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you guys. Please reach out.